Isaiah chapter 9, 2 through 7. Hear the word of the Lord. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. You have enlarged the nation and increased their joy. They rejoice before you as people rejoice at the harvest, as men rejoice when dividing the plunder. For as in the day of Midian's defeat, you have shattered the yoke that burdens them, the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor. Every warrior's boot used in battle and every garment rolled in blood will be destined for burning, will be fuel for the fire. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing it and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. The reading of God's word. You may be seated.
I've told you before in one or another connection that I think Winston Churchill may be the greatest political leader of the 20th century. Certainly, he was the greatest orator of this century. A friend of mine has old recordings of Churchill's speeches, which he has once or twice shared with me. And one can imagine, despite the scratchiness of these records, what it must have been like to have huddled around a radio in London in 1940, when for the first time in centuries, your country was being penetrated by the armed intervention of a ferocious and hostile enemy, and your city was being bombed nightly. These were the days, you may remember, when there was a mood of isolationism strongly entrenched in our own country, and we were a long way from entering the war with England. The major sentiment in England itself was to negotiate a quick peace with Hitler. And yet, in the midst of that environment, Churchill said this: "Even though large tracts of Europe and many old and famous states have fallen or may fall into the grip of the Gestapo and at the odious apparatus of Nazi rule, we shall not flag or fail. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatsoever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender." What England and the whole of Western civilization needed at that time was a leader who would see that the world was in the grip of a great controversy between the powers of good and the powers of evil. And what the world needed clearly was a leader who would not compromise with iniquity, but one who had a kind of intuitive genius for speaking about personal and corporate martyrdom that may in fact be necessary in order to save Western civilization. All of these things were embodied in this man Churchill, along with many personal weaknesses, to be sure. And yet, during the worst of the nightly bombings of London, Churchill said, "It is when I am Joan of Arc that I get the most excited." and on compromising with Hitler, he said, "I have thought carefully in these last days whether I should negotiate. If this Long Island history of ours is to end at last, let it end only when each of us lies choking in his own blood upon the ground. I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat." If you had lived in London in 1940, every night you would have looked at the sky to the southeast and wondered if this would be the night the German bombers would hit your home. If you had lived in Jerusalem in the 8th century BC, every day you would have peered out from the cracks of the walls of the city to the northeast, wondering if this would be the day the Assyrian army would come and destroy your home and family. The impending military invasion, which would hang over your head, would be comparable to that which hung over the heads of the citizens of London in 1940. Hardship and death, the most likely of prospects. And so you would say you need help. You would say that you need several good battalions of trained soldiers, lots of weapons ready to do their work, trained commanders, steeled and prepared, savvy from many previous battles. And you would say, if you lived in Jerusalem in 750 BC, if God was ever going to be mighty, it needs to be now. But God does not come with battalions and weapons to you in Jerusalem in the middle of the 8th century BC. Instead of battalions, you get a birth announcement telling you that the mighty God will come as a weak infant. For to us a child is born, and he shall be called Mighty God. It fell to Isaiah to tell the people precisely how this mighty God will come. Will he come by being more warlike than Judah's enemies, with more powerful weaponry, with more sophisticated tactical equipment? Yes, God is powerful enough to destroy his enemies in an instant. And Isaiah makes this clear again and again in his prophecy. See, the sovereign Lord comes with power, and his arm rules for him. Isaiah 40:10. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, with the breath of his lips. He will slay the wicked. Isaiah 11:4. Suddenly, in an instant, the Lord Almighty will come with thunder and earthquake and great noise, with windstorm and tempest and flames of a devouring fire. Isaiah 29:6. But when Isaiah comes to explain the strategy and tactics of mighty God, our expectations are overturned by the God who is in the expectation overturning business. And instead of a mighty God come to do warfare for his people, a childlike face peers out at us between the faces of sheep in a stall, in a suburb of Jerusalem. God is strong enough to overcome his enemies and ours by becoming humble and weak and vulnerable. There is a truism that I know we all have heard. If you've got it, flaunt it. Which is used, I suppose, in relationship to wealth or intelligence or good looks. There is a deeper truth, though, that those who have it often know. And it is this: if you've really got it, you don't need to flaunt it. And in a crass way, this tells us something of God. Does he have it? Power, wealth, dominion? He has it so completely that he does not need to parade it. In fact, God conceals his power in the body of a baby so helpless that his parents must flee with him in their arms to Egypt, away from Herod's brutality. Mighty God runs away from a paranoid despot. And yet this child is the image of the invisible God, Paul tells us in his letter to the Colossians. By him and through him and for him all things were made, he says there. He existed before all things, and in him, he says, all things hold together. So that at the very moment that his mother wrapped him in cloths against the winter's cold, he was holding together a billion stars, generating their fiery heat. And at the very moment that he cried out in hunger for his mother's milk, the world's supply of grain and vegetables and fruits were being grown at his command. Why does mighty God conceal his power in the person of an infant? He does it because there is something greater than even his power to reveal. It is his glory. God conceals his power in order to reveal his glory. John 1:14 says it in familiar words we all know. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. If you want to know what God is like, look at his Son. For in him the fullness of God dwells bodily, the author of Hebrews says. Everything that God is in this babe. Everything that God will ever be is contained in this child. Everything that God wishes to express about himself is compressed and expressed in his Son. And so we have seen his glory, full of grace. God, whose mighty power Isaiah often describes as able to destroy, doesn't destroy. Instead, he reveals himself as a God of grace. Jesus, who has every right to reveal himself as mighty God, instead reveals himself how? How does Isaiah reveal the mightiness of God most expressively in his prophecy? He reveals him as a suffering servant. Not only does mighty God conceal his power in the weakness of a baby, but that child grows to be a man who suffers as if He did not have the power to avoid that suffering. Do you think I cannot call on my Father? Jesus said to Peter when he drew his sword against a mob coming out to arrest Jesus. He will put at my disposal, Jesus said, more than 12 legions of angels. Yet he who created all the beauty we see, and he who has the majestic power to call 72,000 angels to his side with an upward glance of his eye, he allowed himself to have no beauty or no majesty to attract us to him. And as he suffered, there was nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was, in fact, a man of sorrows, familiar with suffering, like a beggar from whom we turn away our eyes. Yet it was the will of the Father to crush him and to cause him to suffer and to make of his life a guilt offering, for he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Grace means that God, instead of revealing his might by destroying sinners, reveals his glory by dying for them. Jesus is God, making himself weak in order to show the strength and the power of redeeming love. And this is why we who would follow Jesus Christ and even bear his name as Christians, Christ ones, must not try to be strong. The strength of Christ and the might of God are revealed in our weakness, not in our strength. The greatness of God's power comes to us not when we are victorious, not when we triumph, not when everything is going well, but rather the power of God is made known in us and through us and for us when our lives are falling apart, when things aren't going well, when my health breaks, when my finances break, when my children let me down, when my friends do not support me, when my heart is broken, the mighty God comes to it again. Privileged are those who are, in the vernacular of our everyday way of speaking today, in touch with their weaknesses. Because those same people will then be in touch with the babe who is mighty God. What began as concealment really becomes a revealment. The power of mighty God is revealed to those who have eyes to see that his influence can and will be borne to them in their brokenness. And that though that influence begins in the weakness of a child and continues in the weakness of humiliating identification with sinful men, that weakness will conquer a world of despair and sin and death. The weakness of God is stronger than man's strength. The weakness of God in that tiny baby is stronger than all of the empires of the history of the world. and the might of God brings triumph out of tragedy, gladness out of sadness. The power of mighty God is revealed in a babe to win against Satan, hell, and eternal destruction. Tonight, in the service of Lessons and Carols, which is my second favorite worship service that has ever been created, is patterned after the service that is traditionally done in King's College Chapel, Cambridge, England, on Christmas Eve. A beautiful and majestic time when our choir will lead us in some of the most beautiful music you'll ever hear. One of the pieces they will sing tonight celebrates this little babe, as is its title. But it does so in an unusual way, because as you will hear tonight, the sounds the choir intentionally makes actually camouflage the very words. That what you hear is the sound of swords clashing and the chaos and swiftness of mean warfare as this baby goes to war for you and for me. Listen to these words. This little babe, so few days old, is come to rifle Satan's fold. All hail doth at his presence quake, though he himself for cold do shake. For in this weak, unarmed wise, the gates of hell he will surprise. With tears he fights and wins the field. His naked breast stands for a shield. His battering shot are babish cries. His arrows, looks of weeping eyes, his martial ensigns, cold and need, and feeble flesh, his warrior's steed. His camp is pitched in a stall, his bulwark but a broken wall, the crib his trench, hay stalks his stakes, of shepherds he his muster makes, and thus, as sure his foe to wound, the angel trumps alarm sound. My soul, with Christ, join thou in fight. Stick to the tents that he hath pight. Within his crib is surest ward. This little babe will be thy guard. If thou wilt foil thy foes with joy, then flit not from this heavenly boy. If you are going to foil the foes of your life, the hurt and the pain and the loss and the anguish, if you are going to make sense of the ups and the downs, of the yeses and the noes, of the good and the bad, and all that fills your life, then I beg you, my dear friends, flit not from this heavenly boy. It is an amazing marvel that mighty God would be born as a helpless infant. It is even more amazing that that babe will conquer sin and hell and death. Veiled in flesh, the Godhead we see. The babe who conceals and reveals the might of God. That babe, will you take him in your arms? Will you take him in your heart?